Everyone on Zoom can feel free to speak up if there's any issues. I just shared in the chorus, so you should have them with you. Otherwise, let me know if there's an issue. Last week, we began with a tuba for Moshe about Thanksgiving. Not about Thanksgiving per se, but really about Moshe's attitude towards the American government and towards the feeling that we should feel gracious towards what America gives us. In particular, in contrast to Moshe's own background, where he had come from the USSR, he had come from Soviet Russia, so he really knew the difference in the attitudes between Soviet Russia and the United States, and he really appreciated it. And we talked about Shuva in the, you know, some of the technical discussions that we discussed last week about rent control. That was kind of last week. But I'd like to continue the same type of theme, even though the particular discussion is very different. And I want to read two Shuvot that kind of discussed, and I know it's a little bit ambitious, but they're short, so I'm hoping we can cover both. Two Shuvot, which Ramosha covers, which really, I think, deal with Ramosha's attitude towards America, towards the American government as a whole. And I think it really sheds light, and it's a really good time of year to talk about this, as we're really in the nexus between Thanksgiving and Hanukkah, both, you know, American holiday, a national holiday, and a Jewish holiday, which both really celebrate Thanksgiving, Hodah, and recognizing, you know, our place within the secular government and how we relate to it. So I want to begin with that topic in mind. Here's another story sheet. And cover those two tshuvos. So the first tshuva is a tshuva Rav Moshe wrote. It's actually not dated, so I'm not sure when. But he seems to write, and it's a really interesting tshuva, because he seems to almost preempt those people who may want to cheat the government in terms of the governmental support they're giving towards schools. Right? As we know, the government pays a given type of support to any educational, anything which is, you know, any type of educational place, even if it's a private school, the government gives money towards, you know, private schools. And so Rav Moshe was dealing with the question, I don't know if it was a question per se, it's not really clear exactly from the way he presents it, but some clearly had been brought up whether or not there's some permissibility, maybe it's even possibly, you know, advocated that it's a good thing to do, is to lie or to, you know, mislead the United States government in with regard to the support that it was giving, right? Perhaps suggest there are more students than there actually were, or some form of, you know, avoiding taxes, some way that the government would be paying, in effect, you know, a larger share than it should, or based on its bylaws, towards the school system. So Rav Moshe, in dealing with that tshuva, even though the issue itself seemed fairly obvious, like, of course, it's wrong, don't steal. You know, clearly the, in terms of the actual halachic analysis, he doesn't say that much novel. I think his presentation of how we should treat the United States government is really a strong presentation that's worth just reading and really exploring. So Rav Moshe begins the tshuva. This is the first page. The tshuva on page, the first page, as follows. With regard to the chesed, the real kindness that this government of America, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought us with his own chesed, all of the Shirit HaPleita, all of the remnants of, you know, of Europe, both the new people from Europe and the old people from Europe, everyone who was brought here, all the time, chachamim, and they were able, with God's grace, to build and create new places of Torah in America. And because this kingdom, this country, is a malchut shel chesed, and this is like a really significant line that Moshe writes, that this government is defined as a malchut shel chesed in his mind, a government of kindness. That this government, its entire purpose is to serve the citizens. It is a government by the citizens, for the citizens. Which I think, I mean, you can disagree on, you know, specific policies in American, you know, governance. I'm sure Moshe did. I'm sure he didn't, you know, agree with everything that was happening. But the very attitude of the government, that it's supposed to be for the people, that itself for Moshe felt defined as a malchut shel chesed.
It would be interesting to know what year he wrote this. Were we doing this with Rothko? Were we doing this with Eisenhower? Where does this fit in?
Yeah, I don't know. I was trying to find it, and I...
Well, probably Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, or maybe Nixon.
I mean, he next year we'll see was in the 80s, so the theory could be late. I actually have no idea what time this is written.
There's a whole volume. You can see where it fits in the volume.
Yeah, but I don't know if they're always chronologically ordered.
Because sometimes there's...
Chelek Aleph and Chelek Bet usually are. So you can see where Chelek Bet typically is, but I don't think... So it's a little bit later, but it's not so late necessarily. Because Chelek Aleph ends in the 50s. So it really could be, you know, anytime between the 50s and the 80s. So I'm not totally sure. It's there's a little range there. But if you have any, if anybody has any other knowledge, please share. I don't actually know. Yeah. Either way, so Rav Moshe is reciting this to the Midrash Shel Chesed. And the very fact, and proof to this, you know, is the fact that the government is giving money towards the private schools of the Jewish students. Something which clearly did not happen in USSR. The government was not paying money. If anything, they were mandating, you know, certain reforms in the schools that in America kind of give a certain leeway to a lot of the schools. In, you know, the curriculum is there's a lot more leeway into what curriculums can have. And therefore, we should feel really thankful to them. That even the, you know, the places of Torah get help for their students. So therefore, vaday shekol rashei yeshivot u'menhalim v'talmidim makirim b'chol tevot hamdina. And therefore, it's obvious, it's so clear to Moshe that it must be that every student, every Rosh Yeshiva of all of these different schools, they must recognize this they must have this gratitude for this country. And they pray for the welfare of the government. Rav Moshe in this tshuva, as you'll see, doesn't actually at any point condemn anyone who does any negative behavior. It's almost he assumes that it can't be, right? How are you talking that someone would actually cheat the government? It's almost impossible. So he writes in this almost, I'm sure Moshe was a smart man. He's not, you know, he wasn't born yesterday. He knows, you know, he knows what's happening. He knows that, you know, there were people who probably were cheating.
People think if you live in Zakhar, there's a whole trend of people think it's a very good idea.
Yeah, so Moshe doesn't want to start, like, belittling people. It's not how he wants to talk about it. He wants to talk about it almost as if he assumes that people are doing the right thing. And so you can see almost in his language, he has, like, this... this real belief in people's, you know, inherent goodness that you can't, how are you talking that a Talmid Chacham, the place of yeshivas would cheat, right? It's almost impossible to believe. And you'll actually see, at the end, he's kind of like, why am I writing this tshuva? It's so obvious. So he says, right, everyone clearly must be thankful to the government. And therefore, Aval Vada Enachni Muzharim Yashem Yitbarach Shitzivin B'Torah Torah Kedushat Lizahar Melikach B'Tem B'Kvish Yitanayam Shalak Kavu Litain. And therefore, it's obvious that we cannot take more than the government allotted for us. We cannot cheat. We cannot, bargain or do anything to take more than the government allows. Even if there are like some government officials who maybe like are helpful to the Jews, maybe there's some, you know, not particularly upright, you know, government officials who maybe are willing to, you know, slide things on the books and, you know, fudge a little bit the numbers. Nonetheless, it's still wrong. The kol shekein, and moreover, it's certainly prohibited. It's certainly prohibited not just to fudge the numbers, but to just outright lie. That's certainly going to be prohibited. Shlevashu isur gezel. Not only is it stealing, hariika gam isurim gedolim shlamirat shkarim v'chazavik gnevatat. It's also lying and all these different issues of lying. V'gam chilul Hashem. It's also a problem of big chilul Hashem. It certainly is, you know, at least it certainly reflects very poorly on talmidei chachamim and on yeshivas. And there is no horat heter. There is no conceivable argument or Moshe writes to possibly permit this. He is 100% certain that there is no way that this should be permissible in any capacity. It's definitely prohibited. There's nothing you can possibly say to justify this behavior in any way. And God hates God hates any stealing. And then he says as well. Not only that, it's also teaching, you know, students really poor behavior. It's not just only the problem of behavior, you know, in the school. It's not just what the schools do, but it's also like a really bad societal infrastructure. Especially imagine a school setting where you're teaching students, in effect, that you're allowed to cheat, you're allowed to lie, you're allowed to, you know, as long as it's for the higher purpose of, you know, preserving Torah. That you'll be allowed to lie, and that's obviously a very bad educational message that Moshe is very concerned about, in addition to all of the other aforementioned issues with stealing and lying and or fudging the numbers. Then Rav Moshe writes, so all of this was, you know, almost as like an obvious, and like there's no way anyone's actually doing this, but I'm just going to state the obvious. Then Rav Moshe explains, nonetheless, of course, the Rosh Yeshivot, the people who are in charge of the principals of these schools, they're Yirei Shamayim. There's no way we're actually going to think that they're going to lie. Nonetheless, why is he writing this tshuva? Because Mikol Makom, this is sort of the middle of the third paragraph. That why am I writing this tshuva? I'm writing this tshuva in case maybe there are some of the donors. Maybe the donors, they're not, you know, not every donor is a Talmid Chacham. And maybe not every donor is necessarily an upright citizen, the same way that the real Talmid Chachamim are. And moreover, I'd say, I think what Moshe is really pointing out is that I think when you're, you know, in a position where you're giving money towards a cause, you're not as cognizant of the, you know, the ethical dilemmas in the same way you are if you're actually in the school. It could be that if you're, you know, trying to donate money towards a cause, you're more passionate about the cause, and you may, you know, he says this, you might do accidentally. You may maybe not realize what you're doing is so morally wrong. You may think that it's, you know, for the greater good, that you believe so passionately in this idea of Torah that you're not trying to be a mean, you know, evil-spirited or crooked person. You just believe so passionately that you think it's okay to, you know, that let certain moral, you know, ideas slide. And so
people, it's suspicious how they got it. It's like, so give it to Tzedakah.
Yeah, exactly. So Moshe is kind of countering. I mean, if you already have the money, it's a different story. But Moshe is certainly arguing, like, there certainly is a reason for why this happens. There's a rationale for it, and these people are not necessarily evil people. You know, there's a reason why it happens, and Moshe is kind of countering, this is why I'm writing this tshuva. I'm writing this tshuva for those people. Of course, he's also probably writing this tshuva for some of the Rosh Yeshivot and the principals. But Moshe doesn't want to write in that sense. He wants to kind of give the benefit of the doubt. But for the donors, he thinks that there is a possibility, even if it's accidental, even if they're not realizing. And therefore, he's writing his tshuva. You shouldn't cheat. You shouldn't lie. You should be honest and upright. And more than anything else, we should recognize that this government is a, you know, kind government, a government that really gives us a lot of things. And we should be makir tov and, you know, not, you know, kick the hand that feeds us or bite the hand that feeds us.
He doesn't go so far as to say, though, that if you think somebody's gotten their money by ill-gotten gains, that you shouldn't take their contribution.
Yeah, he's not really talking about where the donors get their money. He's more talking about just cheating the governmental support. That's what he's talking about. But I agree. He doesn't talk about it in this tshuva, at least.
In terms of the donor, that's costing the government money also in terms of taking it as a charitable deduction. You know, I'm not talking tuition. I'm just talking outright donors to a yeshiva.
Yeah. Yeah, it would. Yeah. But yeah. Rav Moshe's final point is also that not only is this true for all of the, you know, moral reasons I gave before and the Hakar Tov, Rav Moshe adds as well at the very end that at the end of the day, we want the students, we want these yeshiva to look good in the American eyes. And he says that Kasher Yadu Mefursam Lechol Asher Talmidei Yeshivot Heim Amivucharim Baruch Hashem Me'azrachim B'midoteyam U'B'maseyam HaTovim. That it's well known that the students of yeshivos are, you know, the most upright moral citizens, and that's the way he wants it to be. We should look, you know, as an example towards our peers. We should look toward America. American citizens should look to the Jews, to the Orthodox Jews, as a, you know, as population which is an upright population, a population that we look to as, you know, a good moral, with good moral standing. And therefore, if we participate in this type of behavior, obviously we will not only, you know, all the other issues, but we obviously ruin our name and ruin the name of Torah.
Did he have, I know this is a little bit off from this, in terms of the yeshivas having appropriate secular education?
He has a lot of tshuvas on that, actually, about their relationship. We'll talk about it at some point.
Yeah, just in terms of New York State. And
yeah, he does talk about it at some point, about what to do and the government mandating certain things. We'll definitely talk about it. He has some tshuvas on it. He's been tshuvas about universities, going to universities. He wrote a lot about those topics. So at some point in the year, God willing, we'll cover all those. But
just to relate this tshuva back to what you were saying yesterday, is Haftarah Shir. He goes about this the way you know, that you were kind of talking about, maybe Navim could have gotten listened to better. In other words, he's saying, don't do this, but he's not saying, you're doing this, don't do it. He's saying, of course, you're not doing this intentionally, but we have to remember not to do this, and don't even do it by mistake, and don't, you know, whatever.
Right.
Like, he's giving them their due, while at the same time making clear that, you know, this is...
Right. I mean, it's certainly a rhetorical move to not criticize directly, for sure. But I think it also comes from a place of, like, it's almost impossible to believe.
Yeah, well, probably before we had all scandals with various from places.
I'm sure there were scandals back then, too, to be honest. But any other comment? Yeah, Ari. Absolutely. I think you're right that there certainly is a question of, like, what are my neighbors doing? What are the other yeshivas doing? How are they surviving? And I think you're certainly, he's countering that, you know, compelling notion of follow along, whatever, you know, what the Jones are doing or the Schwartzes are doing next door. Absolutely. Okay, so I want to move on to the second tshuva. Unless people have other comments on this, I'm happy to engage. I want to cover, so I think, as I pointed out, we covered last week's tshuva, this week's tshuva. It's very clear that Moshe has a certain attitude about America, and it really permeates throughout his tshuvos and how he relates to it. The second tshuva I want to cover is actually almost the exact opposite perspective, where now we'll see, this tshuva is written in 1981. So Moshe has really been in America for a very long time, and he's clearly been established as the post-sake in America, and not only within the, you know, within the Orthodox world, but he's really known, you know, within America as this, like, really great elderly, scholarly individual. And proof is that he receives this really interesting letter. The letter itself, the tshuva itself, does not identify who it is. I'll say in a minute who I think it is, but it's not my idea. A lot of people have suggested probably this is who it's referring to. But the letter begins as follows. Purim Tavshin Mem Aleph, Purim of 1981. So it's probably March 1981 or so. Ma'alat kvod Sar HaMedina HaNichpad V'Chaviv Alinu Me'od, the Sar HaMedina, the head of the state, of the government, who is very honored to us, V'Chaviv Alinu Me'od, Yarich Hashem Yitbarach Yimav Shnotav V'Moshlotov B'Tov V'Nimim, the God should extend his days and his rule for as long as possible. And he's asked the following question. He's asked about the death penalty. What is Rav Moshe's thoughts on the death penalty? So what is happening here? What's the context? So it appears that this is probably written to the governor of the state of New York at the time, Hugh Carey, who at the time had been a governor. He was a Democrat, right? He was a liberal governor, and he was Catholic. And he was anti-death penalty. Apparently, there was the legislature at the time was conservative, and had tried passing. I think it was six times. They had passed a death penalty bill, and each time he had vetoed it. It started already in the 70s, and I think he was continuously thinking about this over and over again, and it's actually in a very unpopular position. I think apparently he lost supporters over it. That's what pollsters said at the time. So he really was taking an unpopular position against his supporters, and it clearly was something he was thinking about. As was mentioned, he was a staunchly Catholic governor, so he clearly felt torn in terms of what to respond. And he reaches out to Rav Moshe Feinstein to find out what Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks about the death penalty and how that should affect his own view, which I think is both a statement to Rav Moshe's impact in America, both, you know, his own stature, but it also does point out that Rav Moshe was kind of right, that if we, going back to the last tshuva, that if we show ourselves as these upright citizens, then people will look up to us. And Rav Moshe really believed that as an ideal, and you see in his own lifetime, that really did manifest that because he himself, I mean, hopefully his community also did so, but he himself led such a pure and, you know, upright life, he indeed was asked questions by, you know, important members, you know, of state. And so Rav Moshe is asked this question about the death penalty. So before I begin, I guess, going through it, I'll just mention the first question. First paragraph, Moshe responds to this question. He says, Reshit, you need the Abir Ikshotai Ba'avo Birata Kavod Asar Medina. First, I want to just express my emotions, this love and this also this awe of the governor, but Davar Sonali Dad Derta Torah, that he wants to ask for what Das Torah is, what is the Torah's view on this issue. Yeah, Bor Bat Torah Shabbat, the whole Torah, everything that's written based on the post game. And also that he just trusts me personally. Even first, it's amazing that he wants to know what the Torah view is. What does that say about Torah? What does that say about, you know, Jews' impact in the world? But also, it's, you know, he's just personally humble. He's like, you know, he's awed that he's being personally asked this question. And so, Rav Moshe, that's kind of Rav Moshe's first take. He just wants to say, you know, thank you for asking me this question. I'm really awed by it. Before we get to Rav Moshe's answer, what do you guys think? How would you answer this question? Right, you're asked by a non-Jewish Catholic governor about death penalty, right? And you're responding, like, how do you respond to this question? What's your take on this?
If you're going to give him the Jewish law regarding only Jews, you would have to tell him about Adim and all that stuff, and then it would be almost impossible to ever impose a death penalty. On the other hand, if that doesn't apply to non-Jews, then, I mean, the question is, are you allowed to kill anybody? Because it's one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, you can't kill anybody, but doesn't mean you can't kill anybody who's killed somebody else. And I don't know what the halachic answer is to that, but that's complicated, right? So, but that's...
The thing is, in terms of being against it, where innocent people have been executed, and that's, you know, more and more people are being exonerated. You know, when I'm sure that was, think in terms of Dreyfus, who wasn't, but could have been.
Okay. The Talmud makes it clear that they're not comfortable with the idea. If it's once in 7 years that they kill somebody that's already baked in Chatzuf or something, and some of the rabbis are, if I were on that court, they'd never get killed. I'd always find a way to find an exemption to it. They were opposed to it as much as they could be. I mean, the Torah does say things. I wouldn't have been on such a court. I would do cross-examination until I could find, even if they don't remember what face the mood was in or what kind of tree it was, and so on, I would get them off. It wouldn't have happened with me. So I think there's a negative attitude to it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think, yeah, Ari, yeah. Absolutely. I think you guys are all kind of pointing out that one of the difficulties of answering this question, I mean, there's one difficulty of just knowing what is Jewish position in general on death penalty, which is not necessarily so obvious. But I think larger than that, there's a larger question of, you know, just because we believe in a certain system and that's the way we should operate as a society, what does that say about how we, you know, legislate towards others, right? So Rav Moshe is being asked. He's not forcing this opinion down anyone's throat. He's being asked his opinion, but it's still like an interesting question. Like, just because we have a certain system doesn't mean that that's what we should tell you to have. You don't have the same mitzvot. You don't have the same laws. We don't have the same judiciary system as we do. And in fact, as we'll point out as we go through this tshuva, the judiciary system that the Torah kind of sets up for Jews is actually supposed to be very different from the judiciary system for non-Jews. And I'll give you like a very simple example. For Jews, if I steal something, right, there's never a penalty of death. If I steal a person, if I kidnap, that'd be different. But if I steal just an object, there's no way I'm ever going to be chayav mita for it. But for non-Jews, look at the Rambam in the beginning of Hilchot Geneva. Rambam says, what's the penalty for non-Jew is death. That's the way that the Torah mandates non-Jewish laws. Of course, you know, the question always becomes like, which non-Jew is listening to us? But that's in theory, that's the system that's created. And, you know, there's a lot to talk about why that is.
The dinim halakha for them is that it's supposed to be a fair court. and you see in jail that 80% of people getting killed are black, that's not a fair court. So they're not filing Shevamitz Vepele Malachos.
Right. So our Moshe is not going to go into all the politics of that and all the details of that, but he will bring that up. You're right. You're right. There is an interesting question to talk about. That you know, we'll bring up, and I mean, our Moshe doesn't want to talk about how fair it is. That it's a very tricky position to start bringing that up. Oh, is it fair? It's, I don't know if it's like rhetorically a great move, because then it becomes a political mess.
Yes.
You want your audience to listen to you. If you start like giving, you know, political opinions, it's not or an opinion which is has a political argument to it, it's not going to be so helpful.
Very natural was here. Sure.
He wasn't sure today. I'm actually not sure how he votes on the correctional.
I'm sure he's against the death.
Yeah, 100% ODA rating. So.
Gotcha. All right. So either way, so I think that's the major question for Moshe. How is he going to respond and present the Jewish position? So actually, it's really interesting. Let's begin with the follows. Ve'ata ashi b'ksara ki be'etzem ne'emru b'Torah onshei mita la'averot ha'chamurot me'od. The Torah describes or depicts that there is going to be a death penalty for very serious averot, very serious crimes. You're going to get death penalty. What are examples of these very, very serious crimes? So you could have said, right, so what are some very serious crimes that you get death penalty for?
Killing somebody.
Killing someone. What else? Anything else?
Avodah Zara.
Gerayot. Chilul Shabbos. Exactly. Great. So that's what I was waiting for. Great. Rape. Actually, it's actually very complicated with rape. Adultery, incest, absolutely. Rape's actually very complicated. There's a lot to talk about for rape, different topic for a different time, but it's not so simple. Maybe it should be more, but it's not. Not as simple as it should be. But either way, so some of the topics are clearly moral issues that, you know, all society should agree on. But what about Avodah Zarah? What about Shabbos? There are some things that you get Chayav Mita, right, which are, you know, only really Jewish things. So Rav Moshe, you know, obviously he's not going to bring those up. That's not so relevant to a to a Catholic governor. He doesn't want to hear about, if you're over on Shabbos, you get killed. So Rav Moshe is going to specifically talk about those things which are more general. But pay attention to the list he talks about. The first he talks about, what are the serious sins? For one, kiritzichat nefesh adam, like murder. So murder is very serious. Two, mine gnevat adam, so kidnapping. Kidnapping is very serious. Umine arayot, certain types of incest, or other forbidden sexual relations. Ve'al echad sh'oved avodah zara, and also someone who worships idols. Now this is rather surprising, because in theory, all non-Jews, especially a Catholic governor, in theory you could conceive as someone who's oved avodah zara. So is he telling the governor, you also are chayav mita?
He's not worshiping idols, and the governor's not thinking he's worshiping idols.
Well, he might not realize, but the way we actually tend to...
Yeah, I know.
And Rav Moshe himself and other chuvot certainly does conceive of Catholicism as a avodah zara. So what does Rav Moshe do? Right, so Rav Moshe, though, does believe that, though. We'll see in other chuvot at some point. He does actually talk about Catholicism in that way. So what does Rav Moshe do? He actually does some really interesting thing where he says, what is the problem of avodah zarah? How does he define it? It's shul shemesh v'reach, so any type of worship of, you know, other beings. She asks, what's the problematic about it? She asks, hu mufkar lasod kol ma shebelibo mimine navalut v'achzariyut shebeolam shebdu harishayim l'tovat asmam. That the main problem of avodah zarah is that it creates this sense of everything being hefker. That everything is just allowed. That everything is for me. It's this uber narcissistic perspective, this nihilistic perspective where there's no values, there's no other that I should care about. It's all about myself. That, he says, is the main problem of avodah zarah. And if you have this attitude where, you know, you have no moral code, where you don't care about anyone else, you believe in this entirely nihilistic worldview, then Rav Moshe thinks that's kind of problematic of avodah zarah, and for that worldview, that's what you get, chiyuv mita for. That's what you're getting a death penalty for. So that's where Rav Moshe describes the iser. I think it's a very creative way of describing avodah zarah, a way which is certainly more universal and relatable, even for a Catholic governor to understand. I certainly think he wouldn't argue that the Catholic governor, who goes to mass, once a week, believes in this type of system. Okay, but now, but then, so their motion, that's their motion's setup. But then their motion wants to talk about why, that's why you get, that's the type of things you get death penalty for. But her motion then wants to say, there are certain reasons you don't give the death penalty. Because, you know, there are a lot of reasons out there. You can read a whole list of potential, motivations for why you'd give the death penalty. But her motion wants to stay clear of a bunch of them. He wants to say, that the reason we give the death penalty, even within Jewish law, it's not because we hate sinners. That's not why we give the death penalty. We don't hate the person. Not only do we not hate the sinners, but there's another reason you could argue, which Moshe also thinks is not a valid reason. It's not because the yira likum haolam. It's not because we're worried that if we allow sinners, we allow these criminals to fester, that the world itself will, you know, destroy, be destroyed. That there's, we're worried about the, you know, the peace in the world. We're worried about the goodness that exists in the world. And Rav Moshe wants to argue that neither of these two reasons are sufficient reasons to murder someone, to give someone the death penalty. Because the Azei Ita B'Gemara, Yavo Ba'al HaKerem V'Yichlet Kotzav. Because as the Gemara describes, who should be penalizing these people? It is God. If who should be penalizing people? If someone does something wrong, if there's a sinner, God is the one who should be punishing them. It's not our responsibility to kill them. And Rav Moshe, I think, in this statement, is actually directly making a statement against maybe some of the prevailing Catholic notions about death penalty and when you should give the death penalty. As there is, I don't want to subscribe to what the governor believed, or, you know, but there certainly is this position in society that, you know, one of the reasons we should give the death penalty is because we should get rid of sinners.
All about this Catholic view. The Catholics are, at least now, I don't know if they were back then, the Catholics are virulently against the death penalty.
Okay, so I could.
But a lot of other Christians, like evangelicals, they firmly believe in it.
So I certainly
think. I don't think sinners should.
Yeah. So I certainly think that this is a worldview that should exist, and Rav Moshe is firmly denying that this is the Torah worldview, this is our worldview. We do not believe we're here to kill sinners, and we believe that there is overall goodness in the world. We're not worried that the world is just going to become this evil place. We are worried, potentially, talk about the end, if society becomes, you know, full of murderers. Maybe we have to take care of the problem. But that's the kind of that's a very different issue than being worried that the world itself is becoming a bad place. Right? That's a very different type of issue. That, you know, refers to like maybe evangelical perspective that Rav Moshe wants to get rid of. Instead, why do we give the death penalty? Ella hu sheyidu inchi chomer ha'isurim elu v'lo yavru al zeh. Why do we give the death penalty? It's so that people know the chomer ister, how serious these crimes are, and they will avoid doing so. It's in some ways, Rav Moshe seems to describe it as a deterrent. Right, as a way of deterring people from doing, you know, these sins, these crimes. If we, you know, if you know that the penalty for you know, doing a certain crime is the death penalty, you're going to avoid doing the crime. But Rav Moshe is actually saying a bit more than just a deterrent. It's not just that it's a deterrent. It's a way of almost creating this educational model for us. That by realizing how serious we treat this crime, it's almost, it gives this impression that it's not just it deters me, it's just, you know, I still want to do the aver, but I'm worried to do it so. Because of the consequences, it also teaches me how society perceives this particular action. That society perceives this in a very negative light, and I'm taught, hopefully from a very young age, that this is something very negative, very pernicious, that should be avoided at all costs. And so it's not just as a deterrent, but it's really meant to be some type of educational model that if the penalty is death, this should teach you how we should how we feel about that particular action. That's Rav Moshe's main first take. Even though he did talk about things that you are chayv and death, this is why you should give the death penalty. And now Rav Moshe is going to continue, and if maybe the first half of his answer seems to suggest maybe they should give the death penalty under certain circumstances, the second half of Moshe's tshuva is almost going to reject out of hand any real use of the death penalty. Because he writes as follows, Umitzad shini, on the other hand, on the first hand I describe the purpose, you know, why we should give the death penalty, on the other hand, Yesh hadgasha al chashivuto shel kol nefesh. We have to emphasize the importance of every living being. We have to emphasize how important a person is. Ve'od chashbonos and other concerns. Ve'lachein nitzavinu. And that's why when you talk about the Jewish court system, and I'm mostly going to list a bunch of these, the Jewish court system, as was mentioned, is very reticent to allow the death penalty. and there are all sorts of procedural rules set up to avoid ever giving the death penalty. Despite the fact that we have it on the books as a real punishment, nonetheless, we almost never end up giving it. And what are some of these examples? They're mostly going to list a number of them. First, he says, so you need to have a Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin is composed of members who all have smicha, all have, and who is allowed to have smicha? Only those who are gedolim biyoter bechokhmat haTorah, v'gam gedolim b'shar chokhmot, they are particularly wise, both in Torah knowledge and in non-Torah knowledge and secular knowledge. V'yu anavim meod, and these people are very humble. V'yirei Hashem, and they are real God-fearing people, and they hate money, and they love the truth, and they love people. Shem balei tova b'nefesh shvela v'chevratan tova. Their friends are good, their society they're good. People who they hang out with are good people. And there's nothing bad about them. There's no evil about them. There's no bad rumors about them. If they had, you know, some type of, you know, Senate confirmation hearing, there would be nothing bad to say about them. And they're very rachmanim. They're known to be merciful people. And for this reason, that they have to be very merciful people, for that reason, the rule is that you don't appoint anyone to the Sanhedrin who is either very elderly, or also Mishein lo banim, someone who has no children. Because the reason why we don't appoint someone elderly or someone who has children is because these people don't know what it's like, because they either had and they've forgotten in the year since, or they've never experienced it. They don't know what it's like to really be merciful, to encounter people who mess up. You know, children mess up all the time. You make mistakes. And a parent naturally becomes someone who is more, you know, merciful, someone who's more kind, someone more understanding, and that's who we want on a Sanhedrin. Of course, you know, elderly people and people who don't have children can be very kind, but as a rule, as a procedural, low cloaks and just like a general blanket rule we're going to make, we're not going to allow anyone who not currently has children in their lives, or, you know, active grandchildren too would probably count the same way, because anyone who doesn't have that, just we want to be extra careful and make sure that everyone on the Sanhedrin is someone who is kind and understanding of others. And not only so do we have to have these kind people, but we also need to have 23 people. It has to be a Sanhedrin of 23. Tovim, it has to be 20. Even though they have such great people, it has to be 23 people. And not only are there 23 people, but he goes on and mentions that there had to be in front of Sanhedrin shalosh shurot gedolim b'torah me'od. In front of the Sanhedrin of 23, there would be a bunch of students. There'd be three rows of students. Each row would have, I think, seven people. So it'd be another 21 students in front. All the 21 students would also participate and listen. They wouldn't have a voice in deciding, but they would be able to listen if there were any arguments presented in the courtroom that they thought were faulty arguments. Then they would present their arguments. And not only would they present their arguments, but in fact, he says, they'd only actually share their opinion if the opinion was to contravene something which would be against the defendant, something which would be, would prosecute the defendant and suggest that the person deserved the death penalty. If, though, there was some type of accidental, you know, procedural mistake, or everyone on the basin was believed that the person was innocent falsely, so then the three rows of students actually had to be quiet. They were not allowed to talk. They're only there to really act as a defense, for the defendant, to act as a way of protecting the defendant in case some mistake was made. Not only that, but also procedurally, we're told, in terms of evidence, what type of evidence is permitted. So in Beis Din, you're not allowed to have any type of umdana, any type of supposition where we're just assuming something happened. You have to actually know it for certain, in which the Torah way of knowing for certain is to edim, who have seen the act themselves, right? You can't just have some type of circumstantial evidence that's not going to be acceptable in any context. And not only that, but even the edim themselves have to be really pure and good edim who have nothing to do with this case. You certainly cannot have, and Mr. Moshe mentioned some of the criminal justice issues, you certainly can have a betach, lo al yedei edim shemavtichim lefotra me'onesh im ye'idu al acherim. Certainly you can't have someone who's being promised that they will be rewarded in some way if they testify, right? And this is honestly fairly prevalent in our court systems, where someone is promised, you know, if you testify against this criminal, then we will, you know, lower your, we'll give you parole, or we'll lower your own punishment, or we'll let you off. It's quite common. Even like the phenomena of like a jailhouse snitch is fairly common. All of these type of things that Moshe is like writing against. Yeah. So all of these things are Moshe is writing against. The Torah does not believe in this. Is not the system we have. The Edom have to have no connection to this case. And not only that, but as well, there's like other procedural issues that must come up. And before you commit an avera that's high of the death penalty, you need to have received some type of warning, right? So let's say I want to be over Shabbos, and if I want it to be able to be liable for the death penalty, I need to have two witnesses come to me before I do the act and tell me, hey, Yoni, if you do this act, if you plow your field on Shabbos, you are going to be high of mita. And I have to say out loud, I don't care. I still want to do this action. And if I don't do that, if I don't respond and I wasn't given this warning in advance, then regardless of the fact that everyone saw me do this, I still am not going to get the death penalty. And so therefore we have all these procedural and evidentiary restrictions that really prevent us from having this thing. And therefore he says one more procedural thing he also mentions. You have to have the Beit HaMikdash be present, and the Sanhedrin has to be present near the Beit HaMikdash. We have to have some type of connection between the Beit HaMikdash and the Sanhedrin. And therefore, because all these things are true, therefore, even in situations, in countries that are outside of Israel, where the government really gave a lot of latitude towards the Jewish people, right? Imagine, for hundreds of years, if they in Poland or the shtetl or something of the like, where really the government didn't really interfere with, communal issues. So nonetheless, despite the fact that the Jewish community had full autonomy in terms of its own issues, and really if they wanted to, they could have, given someone the death penalty who deserved it. Nonetheless, never was there a death penalty given to someone, because the death penalty could only be given in land of Israel, only with the proper Sanhedrin. We were very reticent to ever give the death penalty. And that's why even when the death penalty could have been given, Mikol Makom, Lo Yanimsa Kimat B'chol HaDorot, skip the line there. That's why he writes that the Beis Din itself, Shelachein Lo Haya Ne'eral Mishechayvu Mita El Achad L'Kama Shanim. That the actual death penalty was only given once in a number of years. The Gemara and Makot, the Mishnah and Makot, actually states Rabbi Kiva's opinion that even once in 70 years is what he'd call a beitin ratchanim, a beitin which is a killer, right? It'd have this really bad, name to it, bad association of a beitin that's really, willing to devalues life and is willing to just kill people willy-nilly, even if it, kills only once every 70 years. And so we see here Moshe's really making the point that despite the fact that the death penalty is something on the books, there is maybe reason to give the death penalty. Nonetheless, we're incredibly reticent to ever do so. And he wants to really convey to the governor of New York how seriously we take the value of life. And he doesn't bring up, evidentiary concerns that we have nowadays, DNA reversals, all sorts of, the innocent, all sorts of things that the Innocent Project has, revealed over the years that there are a bunch of people who really were innocent, who deserved death. He doesn't even talk about that. But I'm sure if Moshe is thinking of those type of terms, that certainly would be very, reticent, because we were so concerned about, killing an innocent man.
I always have problems. DNA is not as high as 2A then in the Torah. And
yeah, there's certainly...
I feel that there's better evidence that 2A then would say they saw it.
I want to talk about how great 2A then are, but I certainly think there is a certain part of DNA evidence which is a little circumstantial. Because DNA evidence just suggests, the evidence is placed there. And, there's certainly better DNA evidence and worse DNA evidence.
Depends on the kind of...
it depends on the case.
DNA evidence is mamash 100%, and other times it's very...
Also,
the science of it's not 100% necessarily.
Yeah, there's like...
something Torah doesn't talk about, and it may be...
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, that the Torah might not have talked about because it didn't happen, but yes.
That would be interesting to see if somebody would write a truly, say, if he had some DNA evidence which was in such a way that it could only be that guy and it couldn't be anybody else, and it's not really circumstantial because somebody saw the guy with the gun in his hand or whatever, or the knife in his hand, two Adam even or whatever, but if it was only one, is it possible that science can trump 280, but probably not.
In terms of the fact there's so much video of things going on. you know.
That's an interesting question in terms of.
That count as a witness?
It's a really interesting question. It's not. He doesn't talk about it here. I don't know if he does talk about it. It's really interesting question in terms of like evidence nowadays, especially like a video evidence, like that count. I don't think it counts as two witnesses, but it would count potentially in like a different form, because there is, you know, based in has to any court case, right? There's like the matter you're being that's being decided on, but there's also a lot of background information that's necessary. So I don't know if based in is trying to decide whether or not you know, someone had a illicit sexual relationship with someone they're forbidden to. So not only do you have to decide, oh, are these two people, like, did a sexual act take place, but you also need to decide, oh, are they related to each other? Like, what exactly, you know, are they actually related, and is actually an illicit relationship? And so to figure out, you know, the background information of, oh, what's their parentage, what is their background? So the evidentiary form of how that works is actually a little bit different than 2-8-him. You don't always need 2-8-him for that. And so it could be that you could kind of fit in video evidence within that type of discussion. It's really a large discussion.
What's the scent? Yeah. Also, did she say yes? Did she really want it? All this kind of stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of like background information that's required. And
fingerprints are not considered such hot stuff nowadays.
Yeah, there's like a lot of discuss. Ramosha, I don't know if Ramosha talks about too much, because I think it wasn't, to be honest, I don't think it was so relevant to him. I don't think so many people brought to him, like, you know, evidentiary cases. So I don't know if he writes about it. I can look into it more, but yeah, I'm not sure if he...
If there was no video in Georgia, there'd be no case.
That's right.
Yes, there would be indeed, yeah. True. All right. So that's Ramosha's main point. And therefore, he says, and therefore he ends as follows. I think it's the last line of the second large paragraph. I think Ramosha makes this really important point, which kind of brings us back to what I mentioned in the beginning, in terms of what do you think the death penalty is for. And he says as follows, that the reason, part of the reason that there were so few murderers, so few murder cases, is not just because all of these evidentiary and, you know, procedural issues we talked about, but it's also because the Jewish people haven't had so many murderers, because we've had a certain educational system that really discourages murder. And I think Rav Moshe's main point here is he wants to focus on the death penalty as this real educational system. And his kind of proof is that Jewish people are not murderers, and he argues that that stems from this educational system, that we really don't believe in murder. I mean, I've never heard of like an Orthodox Jew murderer. I'm sure there has been, but I personally have not heard of
in Israel over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, I shouldn't have asked.
After that.
All right, I could have known that if I said that, people were going to start naming. Yeah, okay. So it could be. It could be happens, you know, here and there, but it's fairly rare. It's fairly rare. I mean, when you talk about Jewish Orthodox crimes,
we're not. Two in the shul here we're talking about. It may be a third.
It's fairly rare, though. It's I think we talk about Orthodox Jewish crimes.
I'm not sure how from either of those people were, though. But anyway.
Either way, the tends to be that the crimes tend to be, you know, more of the white, you know, white collar criminal issues. It's a little bit different. Most of the crimes that we can't commit, and I think partly it has to do with education. It's just like it's just so. It's certainly Ramosha's argument that the very concept of death penalty is not so much a deterrent per se. It's more that it serves as a framing of our educational system, how we relate to murder, how we relate to these very serious crimes. That's Ramosha's main point. However, he adds an addendum, that the exception to this is in a situation in which there's a person who, for whom murder has become, you know, entirely hefker. That, you know, human life, this particular individual is like a serial murderer, that they, you know, just take pleasure in doing so. They find there's no moral code which is holding them back. And so for that type of person, perhaps they do deserve the death penalty. Perhaps they really do deserve to be killed. So, you know, any type of, you know, serial murderer might be a different situation. So that person does deserve, you know, death penalty. But when it comes to someone who, you know, who just murders because of Ezu Tanat Mamon, it's just they're doing so because of, you know, the heat of passion. because, you know, maybe there was like some type of adultery in their family, or maybe because some type of like monetary case, or, you know, they needed money, or, you know, whatever it is. So those situations, your Moshe thinks they're not really, they don't really rise to the level where the death penalty necessarily is mandated in those situations. One other case where there is an exception is a situation where there really are there's a lot of crime and a lot of murders. And in those particular cases, maybe we would need to murder people just because you would need to give, to punish people with the death penalty just to, you know, kind of fix society to, you know, get rid of all these murderers because it's just such a prevalent crime. But in general, Moshe seems to take a position that at the end of the day, despite the fact that the Torah does have the death penalty, it is on the books. Nonetheless, its primary purpose on the books is as a form of education, a model for how we should treat these crimes. And in point of fact, the death penalty was rarely ever given in Jewish society, partially due to procedural and evidentiary concerns, and partially due to the educational model that that we believe really in Judaism. That's Rav Moshe's answer, which I believe, I don't know exactly how it affected, you know, Hugh Carey's decision, but Hugh Carey, at the end of the day, he never did approve the death penalty in New York State, so perhaps it did affect it. It's hard to know, but certainly, I think, to go back to our original theme, I think it's very significant that Rav Moshe was asked to begin with. He thanks the Medina, he thanks the country for all it's done, and I think that attitude of being so thankful, you know, lends itself kind of to a two-way relationship, where we benefit from the country, and the country hopefully is able to benefit from us if we act as proper, upright citizens, and we can contribute to society and be up and, you know, be real contributing members of society. Any questions? Otherwise, that'll be the end of the